Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Catherine McLaughlin.
And I'm Katie Reif.
On the show this week, Babak Anvari writes a love letter to Hitchcock in I Came By, and we'll be talking to the director himself before launching into our review. A 25-year-old plays a 31-year-old pretending to be a 9-year-old in Orphan First Kill. And on Film Club, it's the most decorated horror film of all time, The Silence of the Lambs. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. Very excited to have you both on this week. Two first-timers, two people that are genre experts. I guess we'll do the kind of ask you to put it into your own words. Kappa, do you want to go first? Who are you?
Sure.
I suppose it's actually two Catherines, but we'll go with Kappa and Katie.
So, I work for the BFI Sight and Sound, The List magazine, and I'm features editor for Sci-Fi Now. I love cinema and sci-fi, but I'm also particularly drawn to cult and horror films and anything weird, dark or avant-garde. So, and I do have kind of a history in writing about real crime.
All right, well, yeah, all ticking all of the boxes of the things I love. Katie, what about you? Who are you?
Well, I am a freelance writer based in Chicago, Illinois. I worked for the AV Club for about 7 years, and I'm a film subject matter expert, I guess. Yeah, I also write a lot about horror films. I do the daily week-to-week grind of reviews and film criticism, but you know, when it comes to writing essays, I suppose my area of specialty is B-movies, exploitation films, horror films, anything genre-based, anything that is maybe not traditionally appreciated by critics, except for perhaps the French.
We love that, kind of reimagining the canon and kind of, you know, appreciating things that didn't get their due when they were out. But, I mean, I'm wondering about the current state of horror, because I would say last year was not a very good year for horror. Perhaps that's, you know, there were a few great things that came out, but as a big genre fan, I didn't have many highlights. What do you guys think 2022 is shaping up to be?
I don't know about in America, Katie, but in the UK, January is usually kind of a dumping ground for the horror that didn't make it to the October/Halloween. Is that the same in the US?
Yeah, although in the US, for some reason, October is not a big month for new horror releases, which is very odd. Yeah, it's January, and the good stuff comes out in March and April. Oh, okay. In the US.
Mm. Well, this year in 2022, probably because of pandemic and lockdown conditions, we actually got the new Scream film in January, which I think is a good place to start when we're looking at mainstream horror and what's being released in theatres, because it is having that conversation that people are having on social media about popular culture and how horror is changing. So I think there's a line to draw between what slashers are doing and maybe Bodies, 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 which is coming out soon, in that they both tie social media together with their horror tropes. And there's a lot of personal horror as well that's come out. I particularly liked We're All Going to the World's Fair, which I didn't grow up an internet person. I wasn't into creepypasta or anything like that, but I feel that film is so atmospheric and beautifully full of dread and things like that. So those have been kind of a highlight, yeah.
Yeah, We're All Going to the World's Fair was definitely the year's highlight for me so far. That director, it was her first feature film, and she's currently shooting another one, which is very exciting. That one came up as sort of a underground selection at Sundance last year, and we were one of the first publications to review it, so that one has kind of a special place in my heart. I'm very excited to see more horror films from people who did grow up very much online, and kind of seeing that experience refracted, you know, kind of the disassociation of online is a rich vein for horror films and discussion. To your other point, I do think slashers are having a bit of a comeback, because there was also X. I don't know if X has come out there yet, but that came out here back in March. And that's definitely kind of looking at a slasher revival. And I think that what we're seeing is, you know, the so-called elevated horror was very popular for, in the late 2010s. And I think, you know, the pendulum just swings back and forth. And I think that at this moment, we're swinging back towards more, you know, quote unquote, like mindless fun. But I think the newer stuff that's coming out isn't quite so mindless, which is sort of a new and refreshing development.
Yeah, I think also with X, T. West is a director, I think, who is excellent. And he delivered one of my favorite moments of cinema this year when he basically literally skewers the sensitive male director's gaze due to his fear of the sexuality of an elderly woman. And I jumped for joy at that point, but I'm not sure if everyone else kind of was on the same page as me.
Yeah. Well, my favorite moment in that film was when they had the scene where there's, you know, blood splashed on the headlights of the van and Don't Fear the Reaper is playing in the background. Because the 70s is my favorite decades for film generally. And so just the pure 70s of that moment really, really worked for me.
Yeah, it was beautifully done, really beautifully done. And obviously they shot the prequel at the same time, didn't they? But in the UK, we didn't get the post-credits sequence, actually.
Oh, really? Interesting. Yeah. Interesting.
Huh. Very strange. Hmm.
That is upsetting news. I also recently found out that now on Disney Plus, you don't get the Monsters, Inc. put that thing back where you found it also helped me post-credit sequence, and that was also very upsetting news. But yeah, I'm down. I'm watching Pearl in about 2 weeks, and I am very excited for it. I love kind of the idea of Mia Goth as this kind of millennial scream queen. She's so compelling as a final girl and as a slasher. I don't know what you call her, as a villain.
I think also there's something interesting happening with folk horror. So we had Alex Garland's Men, and did you have The Feast, which is a Welsh folk horror?
Yeah.
Okay.
I saw The Feast.
Yeah, so with Men, I feel like it's going back to British folk roots with, did you ever see Robin Redbreast, which was a play for today, and that dealt with women's rights, and this obviously deals with misogyny in a very
graphic
way.
visceral, that's the perfect word.
There was a little bit of Katie's former colleague A.A. Dowd termed metaphora overload for me with Men. it feels that maybe kind of that really heavy-handed metaphor of something like Men, and also with Scream, the sort of remake that just has the name of the original film. But maybe something has ended. Something new is coming out.
I'm just interested of what you all think about the folk horror revival, you know, in the UK, because it was really a Canadian, Kayla Janice, in her documentary, Woodlands Dark and Days Bewitched, that kind of launched that, you know, that revival. And she's radically expanding the boundaries of what's considered folk horror. And I'd be curious, you know, because the classic definition of folk horror is very British. I'd be curious what you all think about that.
I'm very excited for it. I love The Wicker Man. It's one of my all-time favourites. So I'm excited to for filmmakers to delve into that in new ways as well. Yeah, very much so.
I always love it when things kind of draw from a strong tradition. It's something I really liked in Nanny earlier in the year, the way that they kind of got that kind of West African mythology into kind of, a different type of folk horror from a different area of the world. But it's so rich and beautiful when it's done right. Mm-hmm. But we should move on to what is not technically a horror, I suppose. It's a thriller. Let's move on to I Came By. Toby and Jay are a pair of rebellious young graffiti artists who target the homes of London's elite. When Toby breaks into the home of Progressive High Court Judge Sir Hector Blake, he discovers a horrifying secret. So, Katie, are you a fan of Babak Anvari? You know, he did Under the Shadow, he did Wounds, and did this live up to your expectations of his previous work?
Well, this one, I loved Under the Shadow. I thought that was a great film. Wounds was confusing to me. I was a little confused about how we landed there. This one I did enjoy better than Wounds, but perhaps not as much as Under the Shadow. He makes a lot, I would be curious to find out, he makes a lot of stylistic decisions in the way he directs, the way he directs actors and the way that he lights actors and things like that, that seem very rooted in the horror space to me. But then he applies it to films like this that are more traditionally thrillers. And I find it fascinating because it can be a bit off-putting in a non-horror context. For example, he directs actors in this really heightened way, you know, like that. Yeah, it's singular, I would say.
I came into this not knowing anything at all about it, and I was kind of shocked by how incredibly unpleasant it was at time, because it does have a little bit of a, you know, this is probably going to be like a mystery, and then most of the people will be okay. And it really has a very nasty heart at its core. Mm-hmm. Did that work for you?
Oh, yes. That was one of my favorite things about it. The thing that I thought was the most interesting about it was the way that it plays, you know, these really, really dark serial killer elements, mostly through suggestion. You know, the really graphic stuff of, you know, can I say this? Like cutting up bodies and things like that.
Yeah.
are off screen, which I thought was an interesting way to play it that I thought was pretty cool. I thought at first this was going to be a home invasion thriller. I thought it was going to be a riff on Don't Breathe. And I was very satisfied with the way it took a turn away from that midway through.
So, you know, Catherine, Hugh Bonneville is not normally who we think about when we think of a terrifying a figure. I mean, particularly in England with Downton Abbey, he's so kind of cozy. Did he work for you as a villain? I mean, we're not going to go into spoiler territory, but safe to say he's a very bad man.
Yes, from the trailer, from the opening shot, you can tell he's an intimidating presence. Yes, so I think I'd like to chat about how the film deals with institutions and how it's insightful on how sycophantic politicians or people in power have a brazen disregard for human life. And I think it's a good reflection of maybe where the texture of the current time. It's insightful and sadly evergreen on how power is structured and who has it and the way institutions and systems swallow up disenfranchised, and it happens generation after generation. So it's a film that points to the way bodies pile up when those in power and the institutions that produce these people aren't held to account. So the strongest point of the film for me was Hugh Bonneville, this presence. He's a judge, and obviously he played the lovely father in Paddington, so it's inspired that he takes this role with such relish. I really enjoyed his performance. I enjoyed the costume choices. Menacing polo necks really tickled me, as did the scene where he's shown giggling to Rick and Morty. And I think Anvari is so well-versed in film and the way he combines small details on popular culture and politics with a dark sense of humour is where the film was strongest for me. It did really make me laugh. And also his little nods to British culture. So a Bonneville's judge is a celebrated student of a college that sounds remarkably like he's an older Etonian, though they never mention that college, of course.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much about the hypocrisy of this man. There are some points where he's kind of talking about like how much he cares about immigrants and trans rights and stuff like that. Do you think that that is the new face of what we have to worry about nowadays? Like, actually, it's the people that say all the right things that can be the most dangerous.
Yeah, this reminds me of, I interviewed the director Mary Harron about American Psycho, and we were discussing, you know, how the film would play differently if she had made it now. And she said the same thing about Patrick Bateman, that character, that if the film had been made in 2020, that Patrick Bateman would be like Hugh Bonneville's character in this film and say all the right things while doing, you know, unspeakable things in the background with impunity.
But yeah, and especially when we live in an era where you're supposed to be a brand, a lot of celebrity figures are a brand and they pay lip service, and maybe necessarily not with a evil intent on their mind, but they don't always necessarily know what they're talking about or if they actually stand for those things that they're saying.
Yeah, it is one that kind of, I really don't want to spoil it all because it was so nice being surprised, but suffice to say, there's a lot of kind of little Hitchcock references in here. We've got what Babak refers to as a double psycho. Did you kind of appreciate it as like a Hitchcock love letter in a way?
I think partly that's what drew some of the suspense away for me, because I knew that he was doing that, and so I was trying to second guess things and I maybe guessed what was going to happen.
Katie, what about you? Not knowing anything, that must have been freeing.
Yes, I came into this completely blind as well. And I love the double psycho. The first psycho was my favorite. I like the first psycho the best.
I mean, if there was something that I kind of perhaps missed a little bit in this, is from Under the Shadow, like there was such an incredible crisp aesthetic with the black and white. And it was so gorgeously shot. This, to me, as much as I did really like it, felt very Friday night on the sofa, TV, having the great time of your life. But I wonder, do you think that perhaps what was missing was a little bit of how cinematic it could have been?
Yeah, I think maybe he tried to fit in too many threads and they didn't always satisfactorily come together. And with Under the Shadow and Wounds also, those films are so atmospheric and really draw you into those worlds. And I think this one just didn't have that same hold for me. And maybe it's to do with, I found the villain absolutely fascinating and I found that performance great. But maybe not so much with the heroes, as much as I'm going to say on that.
Well, I will disagree with you that Wounds was atmospheric. I like this a lot more than Wounds, I must say. I mean, Wounds, for me, is a bold miss, and I'd rather filmmakers kind of went for it, and maybe it doesn't quite work, but, you know, they tried something exciting.
Fully agree.
I found it, yeah, okay, but I did find it a really eviscerating kind of breakup movie. Yeah, I found that effective.
Well, with this one, there were some things that, for example, I mean, this is right up top in the film, so maybe we can talk about this. The main characters are members of this graffiti crew, and they're notorious for breaking into the homes of the wealthy and tagging the inside of the home. That, to me, was a little underwhelming as political activism. I didn't quite get what I suppose it's to make them feel unsafe and destabilize them. But, you know, there's a scene early on where one of the main characters is listening to a YouTube video and they're talking about meaningful activism. And they mention their project as meaningful activism. And I was like, soft disagree. I'm not sure that this is, you know, the most hard-hitting action that you could take.
Yeah, I found it very refreshing when Percival Axe-Scott's character Jay is kind of does say what I was thinking about, like, this is a bit pointless.
Yes! Yeah.
And then I felt reassured because it's like, well, the film knows.
Right. Yes. But in terms of being invested in the characters and, you know, kind of their personalities and mission, that, you know, it destabilized it a bit for me because I didn't quite get what the, I wasn't impressed by what they were doing, I guess, since I wasn't horribly invested in it either.
Yeah, the tagline's quite underwhelming as well. I came by. Yeah, the tag was, that didn't do it for me either. So I guess what they're doing is definitely underwhelming in the bigger picture. And I think with the way the George Mackay, who plays one of the graffiti artists, is introduced, he's this terribly angry young man, and Vary does kind of progress the story with his other characters in how people mature and grow up and aren't just these angry people. You have responsibilities in life and your direction changes. So that was an interesting way that I thought the film went. But again, I think I wanted it to be nastier. What? I know, I'm horrible. Well, just because when A Clockwork Orange, the music from that, the Henry Purcell's music for the funeral of Queen Mary starts playing, I was expecting super brutal things. But maybe that's just me.
Well, oh, there is a scene about two-thirds of the way into this where I think I actually perhaps as a mother, but I grasped my heart. I was like, so like, God, Lord, no.
Well, I mean...
not enough for you.
Apparently not. There's something wrong with me.
I see where Catherine is coming from, though, because, like I was saying before, there's he does the more graphic parts of it very tastefully, which is, again, a choice, you know, but I don't mind a little bit of graphic violence either, so.
Yeah. But that's all to do with expectation. Yeah, my expectation, yeah. And I think that if you're... it's showing at the cinema and it'll be on Netflix. So if you're watching at home, I think, yeah, it's a decent one to kind of scare you, even though it's a thriller.
There's something about Netflix movies where they're never, I mean, you know, films like Power of the Dog or Roma accepted, I suppose, but your average Netflix potboiler is always a little bit underwhelming in terms of its cinematic qualities.
Yeah, I don't feel like anybody comes to Netflix and does their most exciting work.
Mm.
But having said that, again, I did like this movie. And we should get some scores on this so we can move on to the other two very different films, even though we're kind of staying in the same genre. Catherine, do you want to go first?
Yeah, sure.
In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect. So out of 5 for each.
So anticipation for me was a 4 because I love Babak Anvari's work. I think he's a very politically minded director and he's great at atmosphere and dread. Enjoyment for me was a 3, and in retrospect 3 because it's saying a lot of really interesting stuff that reflects the times and I think will speak to a lot of people.
Well, for me, expectation was honestly a 2 because I was not a fan of Wounds. My enjoyment, I would say, was a 3. I did quite enjoy the watching of it. And in retrospect, maybe almost a 3.5 because, you know, he's doing a lot of very interesting things. I don't think they always work, but he's throwing a whole lot. He is very good at the tension and the suspense building and those types of sequences. But when you pull back from that and look at the film as a whole, he does a lot of stuff and it doesn't all work. But like you were saying, Leah, I appreciate a big swing. So
for me, probably 4s across the board, actually. I think I have a very fortunate selective memory when it comes to filmmakers who have made a film that I really liked. And if there's a slightly disappointing follow-up, I just kind of put it to the recesses of my mind and just remember the fabulous sequences in Under the Shadow. Yeah, 4 in enjoyment. I really was quite impressed by how nasty it got. Some of the kind of aesthetics that like I loved about Under the Shadow, I was kind of sad to see that wasn't there. But I loved the character of the house. I loved all of the kind of daddy issues of it all. And yeah, 4 in retrospect too. So, you know, I'm excited to see what he does next. I think there's this ability that he's had to kind of actually really change a lot between his films and reinvent the sort of movie maker that he is exciting. So I Came By is in select cinemas from the 19th of August and on Netflix from the 31st.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promote for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design, thoughtful construction, and little details that make life in your space easier. And now they're bringing that comfort and style outside with their outdoor collection. Burrow's outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry stain-resistant foam cushions. As always, you get free shipping on every order. Get 15% off at burrow.com/acast. burrow.com/acast.
I'm sure you don't remember me because we were cameras off last time, but I did the sight and sound interview for you.
Of course I remember you. Yeah, great to talk to you again.
It's really lovely to talk to you too. You've been having a lot of these conversations for a while now. I think all the stuff I've done and you're still here talking.
I know, but it's fun. I'm happy as long as everyone else around me aren't bored because they've been listening to the same thing over and over and over.
So I guess we'll start properly with, you've spoken about how the idea for I Came By existed for many years mm-hmm. from film school. In all the different kind of ways that you thought about it, what was the core things in the story that didn't change?
The core thing that didn't change, it was always about a young artist of some sort against the man or the system and the man who is part of the system. And then, so that never changed. It's the thing that changed was what type, originally it was meant to be a photographer, my original idea. But after revisiting it, I realized that graffiti art makes more sense because it's more subversive. And the idea that even within their... within the graffiti world, they're going extreme by breaking into people's the elite's home and tagging the wall, I came by, I'm watching you. I thought that was interesting, so I changed that. And then because also age changed it a bit, because the original idea was far more earnest and simpler. And, I was in my early 20s when I came up with it, but as I grew older, I realized that the world is more complex than I used to look at as in my early 20s. And so managed to layer it a bit more and, but the core of it is the same. Yeah.
Your previous two films are in Iran and in America. For you, did this story necessarily have to be in London?
1,000%. I mean, it was from the moment I came up with it, I was this is such a London movie. And, I wanted to do a neo-noir in London, which these days it rarely gets made here. But London is a great city for it. And I also wanted to make sure that it's not a postcard version of London. You're on the ground looking at London with the characters, a normal Londoner who lives here. So the setting was really important, but the themes of it, the key thing was that even though it's very British, I wanted to make sure that it's also at the same time universal. There's a lot of disillusionment when it comes to power structure everywhere in the world now these days. So that was really key for me that it's both London, but yet hopefully universal, and anyone anywhere around the world can relate to it and enjoy it.
Yeah, I suppose that's kind of baked into the release in many ways, because of course this will come out in time for the cinematic release, yeah. And you know, we always want people to go and see stuff at the cinemas, but like most people are going to watch it around the world on Netflix.
Exactly.
And do you keep that in mind, that it then had to have something that had global appeal and that also something that would work, you know, on a TV, on a sofa, not just on like a big screen in a cinema?
I think I always like keep that in mind. I mean, I'm obviously as a film nerd, love going to cinema, watch a film on a big screen with loads of people. But at the same time, I watch a lot of films on my television, and that's the way a lot of people consume. Well, I hate using that word, watch a lot of great films and TV. Also, growing up in Iran, this is something I was like talking to a friend of mine. You know, during the 80s, it was like, you know, we had to get our hands on bootleg the tapes, like Betamax tapes. Then it ended up being like in the 90s was more VHS. So that was like my initiation in the film world, just like watching these like bootleg videos and like on telly. So basically that's kind of ingrained within me, like making sure every story that I tell, it can be enjoyed both ways. But with this film, I really also, in the UK, it's a fun one to watch in a dark theater with loads of audience around, as well as watching it at home. But like, I think it has like some jump moments and terrifying moments, which could be fun. Like many films. Yeah.
In terms of like those scares and like the suspense that you've talked about, like Hitchcock being a big influence on this, you know, without giving away any spoilers, there's, you know, the nod to Psycho that we referenced, but what other Hitchcockian elements did you want to bring on board? Because I guess the classic London Hitchcock is Frenzy. Was that an inspiration?
It was, but I think most my favorite Hitchcock films are Rear Window and Psycho. And then Vertigo is close, but I think those two films are my favorite. And the idea of like ordinary person suddenly through certain weird decisions finding themselves in an extraordinary situation, that's very Hitchcock as well. And I love that, you know. I think I was thinking about like how I can, you know, we had this conversation before about like how Hitchcock is from Britain, but you rarely get, you know, see these films happening over here. So I was like, I want to bring back those sensibilities, you know, and I make a London-based Hitchcockian neo-noir thriller. So yeah, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it's interesting because when I was watching it, there's part of me that thought like, oh God, this like suspicion of authority and suspicion of the police is kind of like, that feels pretty present. And then I'm just like, no, that's classic Hitchcock, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Didn't he famously have a fear of police? that is classic Hitchcock. And like, not trusting the ruling establishment and like everyone have their own motives. But, you know, besides Hitchcock, there were, like, a lot of other great films that also influenced it. Like, a lot of brilliant 90s films, of course, growing up. Like, Silence of the Lambs and, like, a lot of Fincher films like Seven. And then more recently, like, a lot of South Korean films. I love how they think out of the box. And, you know, Mother, for instance, was as an inspiration by Bong Joon-ho. The Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Creepy, but then also like Hollywood sort of neo noirs, which like Nightcrawler and The Prisoners, and I was like, well, I want to do this, but set in the UK, which you know, that was like one of the exciting things about doing this film.
Yeah, I suppose it's that classic thing with Silence of the Lambs in that like Anthony Hopkins is not like a particularly intimidating figure and like this kind of like a Hugh Bonneville is not kind of bone chilling when you kind of, you know, as an image in the culture. Like how were you confident that you were going to be able to make Hugh Bonneville really scary? Because the film doesn't work unless people are genuinely chilled by him.
And to be fair, he's so lovely in real life. So But part of me, I don't know, knew... First of all, it always starts with excitement. I wanted him to play this role because I just... Part of me felt like he could, you know, he would be brilliant at it. And I think I was right. And when I talked to him, the fact that he was excited to do it and wanted to do something different, you know, because everyone knows him from his family movies and Downton and his comedy. And he was, you know, the day he got on, the day he sort of came on board, he sent me this lovely message saying, I'm really excited by creating this monster with you. So the fact that he was up for it, and I keep saying that, like, actors with comedy background also are so versatile and have this amazing ability, in my opinion, that they can to tap into the dark side. And yeah. So, you know, for some reason, I had, like, only confidence that... And I felt like it would be exciting for the audience to see him doing something totally different that he hasn't done before. Yeah.
Well, there is a moment where he just says something incredibly quietly that has kind of really stayed with me all of this time.
I'm so pleased.
Yeah. It's the small things, isn't it, that kind of stay. It's never the kind of big slashy bits.
But to be fair, that's, again, like just getting those incredibly intense moments only through performance. I mean, hats off to Hugh. Like, there were moments, I mean, when I was writing the script with Namzi, there were moments we knew that, oh, this is like going to be a tense moment and blah, blah, blah. But seeing Hugh delivering it, or like even doing it in his own way, like it shocked the crew and even me at points. And I was like, oh my God, like that's a great choice. Yeah, like that's classic example. Some of those moments I was like, you know, he's making us jump just through performance. No sound, no nothing. It's like, you know, yeah. Or making us really get creeped out, yeah.
I wanted to talk to you a little bit about the character of Ahmed, who, mm-hmm. you know, not only is he kind of under threat of, like, real violence, but he's sort of been failed by so many people, by mm-hmm. his family, by the immigration system, by the police and everything like that. What did that character kind of mean to you?
Well, being Iranian, obviously, and knowing the plight of like immigrants and refugees, that really important. The funny thing, our very sharp script supervisor came to me and it was like, "Oh my God!" And she's English. I don't know how she found that. She was like, Omid means hope in Farsi. Did you choose that on purpose? And I was like, yes. Oh my God, I can't believe you. How did you find out? And it was even like with the choice of name, it was like this guy comes here with a hope of sort of like living his life and then find himself in a you know, kind of a pickle. That was, the whole idea, the central theme of the film is how institutions fail us. Whether it's like big institutions like police force or government or smaller institutions like our family and friendship groups. And if you think about it, all the characters at some point are getting failed, either by big institutions or smaller institutions. And I think Omid was like the combination of all of that because he's been failed by the system and his family. And, you know, So it was like almost like the focal point, if that makes sense. Yeah.
I also wanted to return to the house, the poor house that Ahmed finds himself in. Mm-hmm. That has such a character. Like, what were the things you were looking at when you were hunting for the house that like so much of the action takes place in?
It's interesting. I think that. I had obviously an idea of the house in my head when I was writing it, but I've learned from, you know, since Under the Shadow that like you have one idea, but you need to be flexible because sometimes you find a location that's actually better than the one that you had in mind. And I think the house we found ended up being perfect because of the long, narrow hallway when you enter. And we start comparing it to like a monster, like, you know, like Hades' three-headed dog. I forgot the Greek name of it, but like it's almost the house is like Hector's version of it. And like you enter it, and it's like has bits. Like the door is the mouth, and then the hallway is like the throat, and obviously you get deeper, go into the basement, and so I think we managed to find a perfect house, and from the outside. Lovely house, but from the outside, it also had like this weird Amityville sort of vibe to it. So yeah, that was like pure luck. We saw a number of houses, and this was like the third or fourth one that we, you know, like we nearly got the other three, but then it fell apart. So it was always a reset. But then I think it was a blessing in disguise.
Yeah, and it's got that real kind of nothing to see here atmosphere in this house. Like yeah. You can believe that people would be pressed up against the windows, and you know people would walk by.
It's exactly that, and you know it's a little bit sort of like Lynchian in that sense, like Blue Velvet. Like I wanted that, like this leafy, beautiful neighborhood, rich neighborhood. Has secrets, you know, and like you literally things are happening inside behind closed door that you have no idea of.
Yeah, I think I'll end with, so, you know, this is your third feature. We've got Under the Shadow, Wounds, and now this, and this, you know, you could kind of, I suppose they kind of fall under a genre category, mm-hmm. but they're such different films, mm-hmm. different continents and tones and aesthetics. Like, do you see a thread that kind of connects them in terms of the types of films that you make?
It's a very interesting question. I mean, I love to show variety. I mean, I know the first two films were more horror. This one is more like a thriller, if you can categorize it. But I think, first and foremost, I think for me, it's like using something grounded, like the groundedness of like character relationships and character dynamics, but then balance it with genre elements, which that's one thing that I always wanted, love to do, like with Under the Shadow and this one, you know, like putting kind of real people in really extraordinary situations. That's like, that's something that really excites me for some reason. I guess it's a sadist side of me as a filmmaker. I was like, how about like putting ordinary, seemingly ordinary people in very crazy situations? Let's see how they're going to behave.
And it's the masochist inside me that loves to watch.
Exactly. It's a fun bit.
Thank you so much. Next up, Orphan First Kill. This prequel to 2009's Orphan has Esther orchestrate an escape from an Estonian psychiatric facility. She travels to America by impersonating the missing daughter of a wealthy family. Catherine.
Hello.
I've got to imagine, is watching as much genre as you do, there's a wild variety in quality to like any given week.
So yes, but I do really enjoy the trashy horror, and I feel this fits in that mold. So the original Orphan film, directed by Jaume Collet Serra, I think he's a really great director of building tension. So he did The Shallows as well. And so the original film starts, it's very much more serious minded. So it's genuinely suspenseful and upsetting. And the final twist comes so completely out of the blue that it was a film that really stuck with me. So yeah, it's a prequel. And we have Isabel Fuhrman playing the same character, and she's 9 years mm-hmm. old in this one. So that is off-putting. but you know this going in, so you're prepared for it, and you either go with it and enjoy it.
I was not prepared.
You were not. So yeah, like the original film, the most of the way through it, you're with Vera Farmiga's grieving mother for a daughter she lost in childbirth, and it's touching, and it's a portrait of marital strife. In this one, you're just watching the origin story of Esther, where she came from, and it doesn't really care that much about why she's lost her humanity. It's more interested in the cat and mouse games and the brutality of the kills and things like that. So, yeah, I remember seeing the trailer for William Brent Bell's The Boy and thinking, I can't wait to watch this enjoyable trash with my friends. But I found it very boring. I think it made me laugh once. But with Orphan First Kill, I genuinely think he has an ace up his sleeve simply from the casting of Isabel Furman reprising her original role. She's clearly having so much fun playing Esther again. And this time the audience go in knowing full well what game she's playing. So there's room to push it even further into absurdity, which I think the film does extremely well. But we can't give much away as to how it does that, because it's a different thing that happens this time.
Yeah, I don't have terribly fond memories of Orphan, the first one. Like, I didn't really remember much about it aside from the moment where she's revealed to be a fully grown woman. Mm-hmm. Katie, did you like Orphan as an original, and did this kind of live up to your B-movie love?
Well, yeah, I mostly remember the original Orphan for the twist. I don't remember a whole lot about it otherwise, to be honest. This one, I think Isabel Furman is actually she's a good actress. There was a film called The Novice that she was in last year that was, I thought she was quite good in that film. And she's one of the better actors in this film as well. And, I think that her casting gives the film sort of a baseline level of camp that the rest of the film never really, like, it tries to live up to it, but doesn't quite get there. This reminded me of an elevated version of, I don't know if you have these, Lifetime thrillers. It's a big, this reminded me of an elevated Lifetime thriller. It had a lot of the same kind of beats. You know, like you have the competition between, a lot of Lifetime thrillers. You know, if the listeners aren't familiar, they're made for TV movies. I have a thesis that they are the drive-in films of our era. But they are mostly aimed at middle-aged women. And there's channels that play them 24/7, and they're these trashy thrillers aimed at middle-aged women. And a lot of them hinge on similar dynamics with Orphan, where you have this outsider who comes into the family and threatens, you know, the sanctity of the family with her scheming. And this film did some clever things with playing with that dynamic, where you have Esther and then her long-lost mother, played by Julia Stiles, and the competition there reminded me of, you know, a big-screen version of that type of film. And a lot of those films often draw from real life and true crimes and just, to be blunt, straight-up rip-off details from real life. And this film did that as well. So, yeah, I enjoyed it on that level, but I didn't think it ever really rose that much farther above, say, a good, you know, Lifetime wine and popcorn on the couch type of movie.
I do like a good Lifetime. I used to watch them back in the day. There's one with Tori Spelling called Mummy, May I Dance with Danger or something. I watched about. Yeah, there's a time and a place for them. But obviously with this, we have a fully grown woman pretending to be basically in the role of a child. It's as much as kind of B-movie kind of jankiness can be very endearing. Did it work for you at all? Did you ever buy her as a child?
No. The apple boxes and the camera angles and, you know, the child doubles and all the little tricks that the director pulled out to make her look, you know, shorter in stature, you know, those were effective enough. But she looked like a teenager in the face to me. Every time they cut to her face, I'd be like, oh right, this is a grown woman. So that continually took me out of the story, which, like I said, kind of established a baseline level of camp for the whole thing for me.
Did anyone rewatch Orphan? I watched the prequel and then I rewatched Orphan. Did anyone else do it in that way?
I just watched the YouTube video of the bit where she takes off her makeup and is revealed to be an older woman. I was like, that's the bit, isn't it?
I mean, yes. Obviously, there are a few callbacks to her art, her neon glowing art, and things like that. I probably went too much into the into the orphan backstory, but I genuinely enjoyed Isabel Fairman's performance. She really knows how to shoot a dirty look. I enjoy that. And then when she gets back into the beret and her hair tied up and things in the prequel, it's a massive reveal, and it's very entertaining. I think they have a lot of fun with those bits, and I feel like mostly they were in on the joke, but I think you may know more about this than I do.
Well, I think this movie was tongue-in-cheek for sure.
Yeah
I mean, Julia Stiles does seem to be doing a bit of a kind of Joan Crawford Mummy Dearest, like she's not, you know, she's obviously, Julia Stiles is a very accomplished actress. I think she was certainly in on the joke.
Yes.
Is that what she was up to? Because I was watching the film going, was she secretly not a good actress this entire time?
Oh, no, she's great. Don't say that. But the mopey
well,
dad.
Well, I didn't.
I'm not sure the mopey dad was in on it. I just love her angular features. She's so cat-like. And I think she was very well cast against Isabel Fairman. Their scenes together are very entertaining.
God, entertaining just seems like damning with such faint praise when it comes to films. It's a bit like when you call like a painting decorative. It's like, that's not what it's supposed to be. That's supposed to be like a symptom, not the disease.
Well, I mean, I mostly found myself entertained. I mean, the filmmaking in this was very entertaining to me. Like I said, they do a lot of camera tricks to make Isabel Fairman look as though she's, oh, I don't know, you know, 10-year-old size, child-sized, when she's actually 5'3". I looked it up, which is pretty normal size for an adult woman. And that this whole film looked like it was shot through a dryer sheet. The light was so diffused. The whole thing was just so misty. And at first I thought they were going for a gothic horror type of thing. But later on I thought, so is this just to try to make her look younger? Is that why it's filtered like that?
It was so murky and dully directed, I must say. And that's exactly why, I think, just so that you can't notice how old she actually is.
Oh god, I didn't pick up on that. I was just so laughing my ass off at every bit that it swapped out and was just a little child was appeared from behind.
I think I just enjoy when women playing psychopaths. I find it very entertaining, and I think she really got into it. So quality wise maybe a bit less than Neil Jordan's Greta, with Isabelle Huppert playing the psycho in that.
That was a fun one.
Yeah, that was really
fun. That was a fun one. Yeah.
So a bit lower in quality wise, I'd say. Than that.
I think that's fair. Should we get some scores on this before we move on? Katie, do you want to go first? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Well, anticipation 4 stars, because, you know, I had heard how nutty this movie was before I watched it. Enjoyment, I would say 3 stars, because there were parts of it where I was just sitting there going, come on, let's go, ramp it up, go for 11. You know, we've been at a 7 or an 8 for a long time. Let's go to 11, take it over the top. And it didn't do that as often as I was hoping. It was more just these scattered moments where you kind of, you know, shriek and jump off the couch for a moment. But it didn't sustain a high level of bonkers. And I mean that as a compliment. When you're talking about a film like, say, Malignant, the whole last 10-15 minutes of that movie is just completely bonkers and wildly entertaining. And this movie never really rose quite to that level for longer than, I would say, like a minute at a time. And so it was only a 3 for me in watching. And 3 is a total for that reason as well. Although I do think Isabel Fairman is a talented actor.
Anticipation. Sorry, anticipation for me... was a 3, just simply because of the age of Isabel Furman. Enjoyment, 3. I laughed quite a lot. And in retrospect, 2.5 to 3, I think, for me on that. Just because, as Katie said rightly, it did need to ramp up the madness and the bonkersness of it, yeah, for sure.
For me, anticipation, probably a 1. I did not understand who was asking for this. enjoyment, 3. I mean, you know, it's one of those things where I had to, like, think of it in terms of, like, purely enjoyment. Am I enjoying myself? I am laughing. I am smiling. I am trying to not go to the bathroom because I want to see what happens next. So, yeah, that's certainly enjoyment. And then in retrospect, I was kind of going between a 2 and a 3, but I've started, for some reason, my Twitter algorithm is showing me a lot of the behind the scenes photos, and it's all these like Julia Stiles on like giant glittering platforms and stuff, which is making me feel really warmly towards it. So yeah, 3 in retrospect. I repeat this for Little White Lies, and I think my final line was, you know, 20 years, let's bring her back. Let's push this as far as we can. Like, I want to see a 45-year-old Isabel Furman pretending to be 9. Why not?
So, like, so Jamie Lee Curtis in Halloween, she just comes back and pretends to be 9.
Yeah, let's. If we're gonna build a franchise, let's build a ridiculous franchise. Yeah, I mean, how many Jurassic Park movies are there? You're telling me that these people still can't figure out how to not be in a room with a velociraptor?
And there's no psychopathic orphans in those movies, so this one's automatically better.
I think there's more story to tell. So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next up, Film Club. A serial killer known as Buffalo Bill is kidnapping and murdering young women across the Midwest. Believing it takes one to know one, the FBI sends trainee Clarice Starling to interview Dr. Hannibal Lecter. Lecter, a brilliant murderous cannibal, agrees to help Starling if she feeds his curiosity with details of her own life. So, in terms of horror, you know, it's often kind of underserved as a genre. People don't appreciate how great it is, you know. Toni Collette doesn't get an Oscar nomination for Hereditary, Lupita didn't for us, but this one did. This one won 2 Oscars for both of its leading actors. Kate, do you have any sense of like why this film succeeded in the way where so many horror films didn't?
Well, I think that the pedigree of, you know, all involved helped. I think the fact that, you know, you can debate whether this is a thriller or a horror film helped. I think that those things brought it through, and I think there's just a very high level of craft being displayed throughout the film that in terms of, say, its Academy Awards, I think that helps bring it there. And I think that the performances and the kind of like dynamic between Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster fueled a lot of its commercial success.
Yeah, I remember there was a kind of spicy take that people used to have that, like, actually Manhunter was the better portrayal of Hannibal Lecter, because that was much more serious. But, like, Anthony Hopkins is going for it. This is pretty camp, and I think that's what makes it wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, the whole Manhunter sound. It's, oh, the Kinks are better than the Beatles of thriller films is what that is. For me, what's interesting, you know, this was one of the first horror films that I ever saw, actually. I saw it at a sleepover when I was young, and really loomed large in my imagination for that reason, and so I hadn't seen it for a long time, and then I saw it again, and then more recently I've come to know this film in a different context as controversial and, you know, problematic and of its time, and, you know, looking back at it through the lens of, you know, the discussions about true crime in the 2010s and, you know, discussions of the character of Buffalo Bill and, you know, through the lens of trans issues, kind of, actually, brought this film down in my imagination a little bit. But then when I watched it again yesterday, I was like, oh no, this is, I was really taken with the direction, actually, watching it again, and the cinematography. Mm-hmm. Like I was saying, I just felt that the level of craft in this film is so high.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I have to kind of check my own defensiveness, because I do remember, I've read a lot of things all about how, you know, the gender politics, particularly around Buffalo Bill as a trans character, are, you know, pretty odious at times. And because I like this film so much, I think I talked myself into it, that it's really not that bad, but it's not great.
No, it's of its time, though. You know, I think it's important to look at these things in context. Like, for me, you know, at this point, the character of Clarice Starling is a bit of a cliche, you know, the strong female character. And there are certain things about her that are a certain kind of wish fulfillment for problematic true crime white ladies. I'll just say that. Who think, you know, oh, well, I'll come in and I'll solve the crime. You know, that sort of like wish fulfillment of wanting to, you know, be knee deep in this world of like serial killers and catching serial killers and crime and stuff that has led to some, it's spun out in the real world in some problematic ways, we'll put it that way. But if you look at the fact that this film came out 32 years ago, that character was groundbreaking at the time.
And then you read the book, and actually what happens to her is one of the most disheartening things ever. So nobody read the sequel to the to Silence of the Lambs. It's what happens to Clarice is very upsetting. Catherine, is this like a film that you've revisited a lot of times? It just feels like everybody has seen Silence of the Lambs at least once.
Oh yeah, I've watched it lots of times. And coming at it after speaking about two films that have kind of, I would say, iconic or interesting, fascinating villains. So we've just talked about I Came By, and we've just talked about Orphan, which what you remember is maybe the villain. We'll see how time tells with I Came By. And I read a really great piece by Amy Talbin in Sight and Sound when she wrote about serial killers in the 90s, and the piece is called Wolves, Lambs and Clarice Starling, The Rise of the Serial Killer in 1990 Cinema. And it's absolutely fascinating how she ties together Psycho, Silence of the Lambs, Twin Peaks, and I feel maybe we can add I Came By to that list. And it's so insightful on the film's use of gothic imagery and how it does a similar thing to Angela Carter's The Bloody Chamber by taking a familiar narrative at that point of the male investigating crime and crime against women. And we have Jodie Foster's character protecting, wanting to protect the woman and to save her. So yeah, at the time that was very, very well done, and Jodie Foster's performance is good. And I guess Jonathan Demme, as far as the direction goes, came from the Roger Corman School of filmmaking, so he was very much nurtured by him. And there's a great quote in Corman's biography that Jonathan Demme goes into, so, and I think it works with what he's done with Silence of the Lambs. So he says, find legitimate motivated excuses for moving the camera, but always look for ways to move it. Use as many interesting angles as you can. Don't repeat composition and close-ups, and make your villain as fascinating as your hero. And I think he does all of that. And Anthony Hopkins staring directly into the camera, very rarely blinking, is terrifying. And Jodie Foster, the way her extreme close-up is shot as well. Yeah, I think their interactions and their back and forth are so intense and beautifully done that you can't help but become involved with that film. Yeah.
Absolutely. And in terms of the direction, another thing that you can tell that he came up on B-movies is, like you were, you know, talking about that dynamism and no wasted shots. Mm-hmm. This film is so efficient and crisp in the way it's directed. Like, for example, you know, there's the scene where they're in the funeral home and there's a funeral going on and Clarice walks up to the coffin and then, you know, very plainly, without any real, you know, show or fuss, there's no musical cue, he just cuts he cuts to her face and then he cuts back to her father in the coffin and then he cuts back to her as a little girl and he tells you so much about her psychology and her feeling in that moment and her background with two very plain-spoken shots. And that kind of direction, I think, it contrasts with the real depravity and grotesque nature of the crimes in the film. It almost enhances it by how efficient and plain-spoken the direction is.
Yeah, for sure. And just, I mean, all those shots of Clarice existing in a man's world. I mean, the elevator shot's a very famous example of that, where she's just overshadowed by this group of men in this tiny space. And throughout the film, Demi does that in a lot of shots. Just before that funeral shot, she's surrounded and kind of condescended to by her, investigator, like the man in charge.
I mean, for me, one of the most terrifying things that, you know, sort of almost stayed with me more than I think than anything else I watched at this time, because I think, like most people, I watched this film far too young. I was about 9. But the night vision shot is the one that really feels so ingenious in retrospect. And I don't know that anybody since has kind of employed it quite as scarily, the way that he edits that. And he really takes his time. There's such patience in that moment.
Definitely. And I think that's one of the things I really noticed this time around, because in one of the training sessions, she's told that she's dead because she hasn't looked over her shoulder at one point. And it calls back to that in the night vision shot. And it's so creepily done, because you can't see what the danger is. The danger's lurking there all the time. And I think, yeah, that scene is exceptionally well done and very terrifying. Yeah.
Well, to add to that, that's another little character detail I noticed that I was really taken with when I watched the film again is, like you were saying, there's a training sequence early on, and it does show up at the end when she breaks into the house. From the moment she breaks into the house, she's following protocol. She's got her back to the wall. She jumps out into the room and clears the room. She shuts the door. She's doing everything, you know, the way that she has been trained to do it. And I think it says a lot about the character.
For sure.
I would put Silence of the Lambs in the same category as, like a Jaws, Exorcist, Godfather, where it really built on not particularly great source material. I don't think the books are really a patch on the film, if you ask me. But I was a big fan of the TV show that Brian Fuller did. Did you guys watch that show?
I loved that show. Yeah, Mads Mikkelsen's incredible in that.
And they took kind of an opposite approach. They took a very romantic... Grand Guignol, is that how you say it? My French is not great. approach to the material, which I think is different from the way Silence of the Lambs filmed it.
Yeah, I would find myself getting to the end of episodes of Hannibal and having to read the synopsises back on like the AV Club or Vulture or whatever it was, because I had no sense of what had happened, because I was just so enjoying like this feast for the eyes. I was just like, so somebody got killed by someone who's into bees? Okay.
into the mushroom scene, is that the first episode? That was really memorable. And him just jumping over the counter, going to murder with the knife. That scene's incredible too. But yeah, I love the way the two characters play off each other and the homoeroticism of that whole show. I love it. I can't get enough. It's gorgeous.
I mean,
there's a final moment. There's just a final moment where the final moment of the series, and you know, if they were going to get another season, we were going to get Clarice introduced, but it does end before that. And there's such an intense romance to the final few frames of it. And that they don't kiss kills me to this day.
So true. That's what we're waiting for.
I mean, I think even in this film, between Hannibal Lecter and Clarice, it's more of the element of sexual danger that Claire Reed's faces throughout the film. She kind of knows that this is why she's got this assignment, is because, you know, he'll talk to a young pretty woman and someone says this as much to her in a condescending way, actually. And so there's this theme that runs throughout Silence of the Lambs, and I think it's pretty sensitively observed, considering it was like a male director, of the way that everyone, that she exists in this constant state of, you know, whether it's Hannibal Lecter leering at her, or the other prisoners, you know, throwing things at her, or men condescending to her, it's a struggle to assert herself and her humanity in this world where everyone always just views her as like a sexual object. That's a theme that runs throughout this film.
And the objectification of the women that Buffalo Bill is tearing the skin off and making a suit for, which is deeply, that's just, that whole idea is deeply upsetting.
Ed Gein, right? That's another Ed Gein kind of.
Well, that's another connection to Psycho, obviously, and which this film plays off in certain ways. Yeah.
It is funny the kind of people that capture like the public imagination. Ed Gein's had so many good movies.
Good average, huh?
Yeah,
Ted Bundy, not a one landed for me.
I was gonna say much better film ever than Ted. I hate every Ted Bundy movie that comes out. I don't know why.
I think it's because we keep insisting that he was sexy.
True,
true. He simply was not.
No, I'm sure he was a creepy, creepy presence.
God. Well, on that note, we should wrap things up. So if you've got thoughts on these films, email truthandmovies@tcolondon or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, egos clash in an official competition. There's Regency Romance in Mr. Malcolm's List. And Film Club is Bette Davis versus Anne Baxter in All About Eve. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Catherine McLaughlin and Katie Reif. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Jake Cunningham.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.